Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sazzy. I'm from South London and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is there a song that you wish had been written about you? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello everybody, welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian and writer Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer,
hello,
and a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from
our question from Sazzy from South London. Her question was, is there a song you wish had been written about you? Dane, any songs that leap to mind?
Song I wish had been written about me?
Nobody Does It Better?
That's a good one.
That's an option.
Oh, and You're So Vain. I like that.
That's pretty good, actually. Cotton Eye Joe? No, that seems inappropriate.
I think the song that I would like to say probably represents my stream of consciousness is a song called Take It in Blood by Nas.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's like my favorite song. And I think, yeah, it's the epitome of like of poetry. Urbane poetry, so I love that song. So that's the song I wish was about me and my life.
And that's pretty good. I think I'd have to go for You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman by Aretha Franklin, just to confuse everyone. Or maybe What Becomes of the Broken Hearted, actually. That feels like it's more
Either or, although, you know, we were no longer referring to people who feel like a woman as confused.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to go for I'm Still Standing. I'm going to go for I'm Still Standing by Elton John. Fuck you, world. I'm still going. Before I get in trouble. Anyway, we ask all the questions, don't we, Dane? We ask all the questions.
We ask all the questions. No punches are pulled. And if you have questions to ask us and you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network, where you can find us there also. On today's show, our guest is a British actor, writer, director, producer, and activist. He is one of the creators and stars of the BAFTA award-winning BBC comedy show, The Revolution Will Be Televised. He co-created the ITV2 show, Don't Hate the Players. He also created the comedy show, Revolting, which produced one of the most controversial sketches of all time, The Real Housewives of ISIS. It's the anarchic Jodian Rubenstein.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
Hello. It's good,
man.
I'm glad we got into
The Real Housewives of ISIS at the top of the show.
I thought I'd get it out of the way.
The least problematic sketch that we ever released. That's for sure. Just listen. Really weird when a sketch just does nothing. Just doesn't talk to anyone. Yeah. Doesn't really get a response.
I like it. I thought it was great. And I feel like, you know, for people that would have been detractors for that particular sketch, it's like, what are you more outraged by? By a parody of something or what's actually taking place? And, you know, satire is a tough one.
It's problematic, though, because we live in a world of such binaries where... You know, the women who had been groomed online to go to Raqqa were living in a sort of full-on Wahhabist Islamic, crazy place. So they were wearing, you know, hijabs in the sketch. But I do, if the one thing I regretted actually was that if I was to do it again, I'd just have them in fighters' outfits, because we're living in a time where just the visual of the sketch itself was enough to get people like Katie Hopkins and Alex Jones go like, oh my God, this is fantastic. This is amazing. Listen, when you're a satirist, it's not like you're not hoping to get a response, but that's not necessarily the crowd I was expecting to jump up and down.
it reminds me of when I was pitching a show, which I tried to get a kind of hidden camera prank thing, political thing commission. And I remember talking to someone about it and then going, yeah, I really like it. Why didn't you call it Nigel Farage's Happy Hour? And I went, right, this is over. This is all over. I'm never mentioning this again. Nigel Farage's Happy Hour? Fuck off. I'm not making that.
I've been in some fucking crazy development meetings. I won't tell you which company this is, but I was literally in a development meeting where a guy went, so what we'll do, is we'll get a Muslim woman, yeah? And we'll put her in a hijab. We'll just put her in a cage. We'll put the cage in Covent Garden and we'll just see what happens.
Do you know what? White privilege is not just a facet of institutional racism. I believe that it is a strain of cocaine that is affordable only to the media elite, yeah. Where someone goes, all right, yeah. H&M, we're going to take a little black boy with a T-shirt and it's going to say, monkey! Yeah.
It was crazy. It was crazy because, you know, I'd hear these ideas and I'd sort of say, okay, but what's the sketch saying? And they'd go, like it. And you were like, sorry, what? I'm just asking, what are you trying to say with this sketch? And, you know, it's strange times. I mean, the backlash mainly that we got, and there is nothing, you know, they say there's no such thing as a woman scorned. Mm. You know, they say that.
Hell hath no fury, of course.
But it's not true. What hell hath no fury than a woke, liberal, white man. They will pile in on top of
things. Absolutely.
And it's not, there are great things about that. And, you know, I definitely think at times I am that guy. But it was really interesting watching, you know, that stuff. It's a hard thing, though, because, you see, we were living in a different time.
I was about to say, you and your work, particularly with Revolution Will Be Televised, to me, feels now ahead of its time. Because if that show was happening right now, it would be like creating noise in a way that maybe a few years ago, people were just more like, yeah, what kind of crisps can I buy? Whereas now it's like, you know, there's a lot more activated bits of people's brains politically, even if they're talking bollocks.
Yeah, I mean, we probably would be dead.
Yes, I was going to say.
That's true.
I mean, we probably literally, because, I mean, we've got, you know, Hayden was put into the cells underneath the hate when,
oh my goodness.
You know, he put up, you know, wanted posters for Tony Blair. Because what we really did with the show was we basically racially profiled ourselves. We racially profiled ourselves and we thought, okay, well, our whiteness gives us an ability to use this privilege to gain access to the events and the people who will be less triggered by us and therefore will open up their, you know, their sort of evil selves, if you like.
God's done.
There's quite a few I could go into, particularly about police brutality that I witnessed myself in New York, about actually going to the KKK and meeting them personally and the experience of that where you realise, like, these guys are no fucking joke. Like, this whole, you know, that fucking Hollywood movie, Green Book, That for me is it. It's like the Hollywood narrative is you get this racist guy, he meets a black guy, he spends time with him, he's like, oh my God, I've seen the error of my ways. Now I know a black guy, I'm not a racist. These guys don't fuck around. These guys are fucking racist.
Well, they're not just that. Those, this is what America doesn't show you as well, is that racist in the KKK and the character portrayed by Viggo Mortensen, the guy in the Green Book is an Italian guy. Now, in America, historically, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants would consider Irish, Jewish, and Italians to all be part of an underclass where white is concerned. The term of white, in which they were all collectively known, only came about to be opposed to oppose the galvanization of former slaves and black people. So just make sure that there was that separation. What people need to understand about the KKK and other white supremacist groups, especially in America, is that their entire identity and their self-esteem, it hangs on a thread to the subjugation of black people.
Yeah.
Because they are indoctrinated with the idea, if you are the lowest of the low, trailer park, crystal meth smoking, white trash, you are still better than the richest black man.
We did obviously a lot of talks after, you know, George Floyd was lynched, and we, you know, tried to talk a lot about like the British Empire and, you know, stuff like that. And then since then I got quite involved on the ground with like the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK. And like, what's really fascinating to me is, and by the way, no one will fuck with this Generation Z that are coming up. Like, these kids give no fucks, and they are very, very informed, and far more informed than I was at their age. And they have different ways of kind of, you know, I mean, it's just like these tiles on Instagram where you can click through and find out the entire historical basis of slavery or the financial realities.
And that's why they can't be fucked with, because now the two greatest weapons that supremacy has had, which is mainstream media and being able to control that narrative, they've lost that grounding as well. Yeah. And also, you know, the finances to do so, they've lost that as well. So now that transparency has been one of the biggest blows. And then someone like Donald Trump, who epitomizes what white supremacy and capitalist patriarchy is, in the fact that he has no real meritus right to his position, just that he's wealthy and he's a white man. He is now, just by his existence, destroying that. Every day he lies, every time he shows his incompetence, even in the South of Corona and the whole COVID thing, every time he shows his incompetence and his duplicity, every single time that happens, he basically destroys the image of a quintessential, wealthy, benevolent, intelligent white man.
I got a good story for you about Trump. So I've met Donald Trump personally twice.
Yeah.
And we filmed him in his sketch once. But the first time, I missed him. So we had flown that morning. We were filming in New York. We'd flown down to New Orleans because there was a Republican Party conference there. And at the time, because this is 2015, he was still like a rank outsider, right? Mm. So when they do like the, you know, various people talking, that day it was all about Jeb Bush, who was running for senator. So he was going to be the main event. Anyway, so we got there late. It's like driving rain. And when we filmed Revolution, I would always have like a lapel mic. Mm. So I zoomed in whilst everyone else was still getting ready to sort of scope the place, see what was going on. And it was a weird fucking place. It was like a kind of like convention center, kind of weird old 80s carpets and stuff. And I'm sort of walking in and I see Trump coming out with like surrounded, they usually have a sort of diamond formation of security around all these people. Mm. And he's strolling out and I see him and I'm like, fuck, it's Trump. Like, maybe we could get him. So I start tailing him back to basically where the entrance is, where our car is with the cameras. And so we go through the first place and he's like waving and there's, you know, various people kind of saying hello. And then we walk basically through some double doors and it's pretty much a totally empty conference room before we get to the steps. And I'm sort of behind him, behind his full security, and he's still waving to no one.
sounds about right.
In a room, right? Sounds so he's, right. He's walking through a room, and he's like, and at first I thought I'm going a bit mad here. So I sort of did that thing, like looking like I'm on my phone. I sort of skirt around the outside of him, and it's like I mean, it's like when you hear him talk on his speeches, it's like, I don't know. Like, and it's got to the point, Dane, where I genuinely hope he was taking the piss with his security guard.
He definitely isn't. It's a combined thing, is that if you look at capitalism as a religious ideology, he's like the Pope. So in his head, that is always supposed to be the answer to stuff. Every time he's questioned about his competency or you know, his insight, he's like, my wealth means I should never have to be questioned. Everything he's dealing with now is this existential crisis of the fact that he has never had to be a civil servant and never had to be at the behest of anybody else.
Yeah.
Because in every other instance, when he's been incompetent, he's bankruptcies and stuff.
Can we just can we just pull up? Because can we just take a second just to acknowledge that he was waving to a completely empty room?
It doesn't surprise me.
It's just like, it's so
That's weird. A sociopath practicing how to appear like a normal human being that can endear themselves to other people. It's remember, weird. Where he comes, when, normally Donald Trump doesn't say hello to anyone. That's why he has to practice, because normally his eyes are head towards the money. And if you approach him, it's his discretion whether he acknowledges you. That's how his mind usually is. So he has to practice. So for us, normal interaction and rapport building with most human beings comes to you naturally just for your normal life experiences. Yeah. He's always been able to pay people for stuff like that. A civil servant is the hardest part, because a civil servant essentially means you're at the behest of civilians, whereas he's normally used to being of the elite as the 1% to look down on them. So to be in the service of civilians, he is in a world that he cannot, but again, because of his money, he can't be like, this is too tough. I want to resign because of his ego alone.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, if you've been on The Apprentice for how many seasons firing people.
Oh, of course.
He doesn't want to say, I can't handle this, I resign.
I think he's just a straw man who is being manipulated because the Russians have compromat on him.
Footage of him pissing on a bed. I wonder personally if, you know, if anyone listens to this, if you can get a chance to check out Trump and the American Dream documentary series, which is, I think, a four-part documentary series you can see on Netflix.
That depends. How does he make money from us watching that?
No, of his name? No, he would not be vouching for that documentary.
Okay, cool.
But I would say that documentary offers the most unbelievable insight into who Donald Trump is. It starts from really early days right up to the kind of modern day, people who knew him, people who like him, people who don't like him. It's a real fascinating...
I'd really recommend, if you're watching this or listening to this, that you Google Luke Harding, who is a Russia specialist of The Guardian. Mm. He's a very brilliant journalist, someone that I followed for a very long time. And he was and is really one of the foremost sort of journalists when it comes to the questions being asked, why hasn't Boris Johnson published the Russia report? Mm. And what he has stated, this is his journalism, not my opinion, is that when Theresa May and Boris Johnson at the time, Boris Johnson was the Foreign Secretary, Theresa May was the Prime Minister, given the Russia report, basically a memorandum that basically stated that it was highly probable that that the American president, if it was in fact Donald Trump who won, that he would be compromised because there was a lot of Russian compromise on it. And Harding says that they just basically threw a fire blanket on this because at that time, with Brexit in the offing, remember, it was all leave and remain then, you know.
What's a Brexit? Did you say Brexit on my podcast? Well, that's 2015, buddy.
You'll know on the 31st of January 2021, bro. Believe. That's when you'll know. That's when the pound will tank. But it's... It's really mad shit. I mean, this is why I find it hard to do comedy about all this shit at the minute. And, you know.
Yeah, satire nowadays is tougher than it's ever been because the truth is much stranger than fiction.
Mm. Yeah.
We should ask a question because our listeners will be thinking this is the most amazing preamble we've ever had on this show. But we need to ask a question, otherwise the show will never get to the format that people love. So
it's, you want me to explain what the question is today then?
Please, yeah.
The difference between abolitionist viewpoints, which look at system change, and pragmatist legislative viewpoints that look to work within a current system. And both in the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK and in the environmental movement, there are very big similarities between, because these are social movements, it's not in any way monolithic, the viewpoint. There are those who believe the best way to move forward with the Black Lives Matter agenda in the UK is to only look at systematic abolitionist frameworks. And that became a very mainstream idea in recent weeks because of the calls to defund the police, right? Which was not something that would be part of mainstream vernacular. Like if I told you in January, you know what's going to happen? By August, people are going to talk about defund the police. You'd be like, fuck off, mate. What are you on about? But that's where we are. And in the environmental movement, that is also something that is absolutely essential because you have organizations, obviously, like Greenpeace, who look rather, revolutionary, but in fact are an organization that works with government pragmatically, changing legislation. And you have then groups like Extinction Rebellion who have sprung up globally, you say, no, you must have complete systemic change. So I think that's what we're going to talk about today, the difference between pragmatic change and systemic change and what's the best way forward.
Dane, where do you stand on this? Do you want to just tear it all down? Or
I think been a large part of my narrative is that we have already arrived at the apex of the functionality of the current systems that we have in place. They were already built, they were kind of metaphoric sandcastles in the first place. And we've just gotten to the point where people realize that our state of being is no longer tenable. An example of that being the paradox of the fact that we were in the process of dismantling and privatizing our NHS. And then we have one global pandemic. Everyone's like, every Thursday, clap for them. Or how about you just incentivize the people that you allow to enjoy offshore tax havens to pay money towards the fucking NHS, and we need to clap for them. You know what's better than someone hearing a round of applause? How about Vodafone paying their tax bill, and then they can pay that? They can pay the salaries of nurses for 3 fucking years. Probably a little better than a clap. So yeah. I think, I'm of the school that it all has to be kind of been torn down, which doesn't necessarily pertain to aggressive anarcho destruction and the like. However, as Jolene stated, there's not going to be any change unless we begin at a systematic and infrastructural level. So with the example of Black Lives Matter, it's a very interesting point to discuss in ecological concerns, because there are no interest parties that exist either within or outside of the bipartisan political spectrum that do take care of, you know, the needs of the descendants of slaves as well as members of the diaspora. So that may would need to exist. And, you know, if that is going to exist, how about a leader that black people fucking know? Because no black people know who Trevor Phillips is. So how he became the Minister for Racial Equality, nobody knows, because there was no campaigning. There was no him, you know. Even, I've never seen Trevor Phillips in, like, you know, the Bar of Brent, which is one of the largest Afro-Caribbean populations in London. You know, he's never speaking to any kind of Nigerian dignitaries, even though Nigerians make up the largest population of the diaspora in London, especially. So, you know, that would be a start. You know, demonstratively protecting, you know, black politicians like, you know, your Una Kings and your Diane Abbotts are constantly the target of vitriol. And it's like, is she going to have to end
up... What are you talking about? She should never have had that mojito, mate. All right.
Yeah, well,
what are you on about? If a woman's going to drink a mojito on a train, surely she's fair game for complete and utter full on racial
ridicule.
Because Lord knows that I guess if you're going to sniff coke like the Prime Minister, you should probably do it in private, innit? So, all right, fair dues on that one, guys. But
it's difficult though. The whole thing's really difficult, right?
Because there's small incentives I think you can do to change it. So yeah, so the environmental one, it's like I said, it's like on the one hand we don't have a black interest group, and then you see like someone like Donald Trump closes the Environmental Protection Agency in the States, and it's like, for me, it's like there is even the financial benefit of investing in ecological responsibility, because for me it's still so strange that you have hospitals, libraries, fire stations, police stations, or, you know, parks, nature reserves, all of these places with buildings that don't have fucking solar panels, and they're municipal buildings. And it's like, if you had a policy where you're like, every single municipal building should be able to provide solar panels to provide an alternate energy source so that these buildings are not beholden to private utility companies and who installs them. How about this entire glut of unemployed people in the north of the country, this entire contingent of white working class people who you could be educating about new and emerging technology like biofuel or solar energy, and they could be installing this stuff. Mm. And so they've got jobs, and now we are investing in an infrastructure which is going to be financially sound and ecologically conscious.
Well, listen, I've got something to say on this, because this is a really key point, and I think this is what I think... You know, I'm starting to see these parallels, and I think it's really important that people have it consider this. So one of the things that has come up as a result of the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK is the odious reality that when the famous Earl Grey was Prime Minister, that he suggested that in exchange for getting rid of their slaves, that slave owners would be paid a bursary by the government through the taxpayers' purse. Yeah,
subsidizing
them. That went up, the subsidy, exactly, that went up until, that we were paying off till 2015. Now, that is something that we've discussed, right?
Yes.
What has not been discussed, and what in fact stands exactly in the way of what you just said, which is why don't government buildings and, you know, government-funded functions of society, why aren't they powered in this way, is that the UK currently has the biggest fossil fuel subsidy in the whole of Europe. So right now, every year, we give £124 billion of taxpayer money per year to the fossil fuel industry. We are so incredibly embedded in the infrastructure, just like the British state was embedded in the infrastructure of slavery, that there is not currently the... there aren't the Instagram tiles of that yet. Do you know what I mean? Like people aren't putting this stuff out yet. And there's a lot of similarities here. And the problems ultimately are the same, which is legislative change can make really meaningful difference to people's lives. Like, I helped a group of people, and I'm always amazed by what they do. I'm never call myself an activist, because I know what real activists do and the lobbying they do. So for instance, the friends of mine who work for Help Refugees, who lobbied on the Duds Amendment, which was to help unprotected minors in refugee camps connect with family members that they had in the UK. So I want to be super clear. We're not talking about just taking random kids. We're talking about people who actually have family in the UK. And the government resisted this massively. And the lobbying made a difference to over 60 kids' lives who probably would not be alive now if they hadn't done it. So that's, on one level, why pragmatism and that kind of legislative change is really important. The problem is that the overall reality doesn't change at all. And that's where we're at. And the problem at the minute, and I've even seen this within the Black Lives Matter movement, where just like with the Women's March, if you look at that, you know, it was one group. It broke off into two because of, you know, I think there was one group that was predominantly Jewish women. There was another group that was predominantly Black women. They broke off. I'm not getting into why they did or whatever. But even now, you can see small pods of people being offended that one group may be pragmatists and another one may be abolitionists. And rather than working together, there's a sense that it's like, shit, man, you're a part of the problem. Or, shit, man, you're fucking naive. You're not, what, you think there's going to be a revolution in this country? How are you going to enact any of this shit? You're just pissing in the wind. So it's a real kind of big kind of conversation, you know, around these things.
Well, I mean, to me, one of the things that is on a kind of human level, potentially part of the reason is even on the most basic level, people fear change. I think in your own life, if you have a routine, I don't know if people who listen to the show or you guys have found, you know, lockdown gave you a new routine and you quite liked it and you got quite used to it. You know, I think people like to have their systems in place. And so major change to those systems, like how we use energy, how we work. You know, I think the idea that it went down to 4 days a week appealed to people in some ways, but I think in other ways it terrified the fuck out of them. Because what would they do? What would they do, you know?
Lack of purpose. But this is what it all comes down to, is that all of the things that we're discussing on these macro kind of global, macro social scales, they all really come down to just assessing the human complex, whereby, for example, as you said, you've got a contingent of people who want to be progressive, but at the same time have a fear that they may not have their needs prioritized over the needs of another extant group. And so then, you know, the real purpose becomes distorted. Or like Howard said, you know, we are creatures of habit as human beings, whereby we're used to a certain pattern of behavior, particularly if that pattern of behavior benefits you or you enjoy the privilege of that. And even there's also the comparative privilege whereby I've had conversations with Black people of a more conservative disposition when, you know, for 10 years I've bemoaned like foreign policy and bemoaned the action of the police. And they'll be like, yeah, but the police here aren't as bad as the police in Nigeria, partially because they've been weaned on a diet of Fox News, which is just, you know, fast food information. But also because of the fact that when you are, people are having a comparison of prestige, especially when you are dealing with a diaspora who are from developing countries that come here, they've never had it better. So to convince them that things need changing can be a very difficult thing. So I completely agree, and like I said, I'm definitely of the position that it's an infrastructural change, but that infrastructure doesn't just begin with the mechanics that govern how our societies run, whether they are economic or legislative. The issue is I think it's a humanitarian one.
It's a whole philosophical basis of our civilization. Why do you live?
It's purpose. But then this is what I mean. This is the idea is that this has now become an existential question we're arriving at. And everyone is doing that very slowly and reluctantly, because whether or not your leanings are towards Black Lives Matter or All Lives Matter, you're going to arrive at a point where automation is going to become taking a much more of a prominent role in just our workings economically and industrially.
So you can see it now. I mean, what you're saying, I'm so glad that you went on to that, because that's literally what I think is the fundamental lie of neoliberalism, the fundamental lie really of capitalism.
Absolutely.
Is that you are an individual actor and that you have agency over the conditions. And people say, well, look, you know, a market fundamentalist, even you know, a rational economist who believes in Hayek and believes in, you know, believes in, you know, the Adam Smith Institute's kind of, you know, take on economics would say, well, no, but look, entrepreneurs are able to do that stuff. But what we've seen with coronavirus is, and what we will see with climate collapse,
absolutely,
is that it gives no fucks who you are.
No fucks. But this is
where you are.
And that's the problem with capitalism, is that you have a quasi-religious ideology masquerading as an economic ideology.
Yeah.
Number one, even the Adam Smith model dictates that a divine hand is supposed to reset your economic systems. Literally. Now, if you've got people that are in the 1%, they're not going to listen. They're not going to allow that to happen. They're not going
to
allow that to happen.
Just to say, if you're listening to this, Dane is not gassing. Like, that is literally word for word what it says.
Exactly. They're not gassing.
People are like, but what do you mean the divine? That doesn't matter.
People don't know that you are dealing with a system which is based on infinite resources. Right. So even then...
do you want to hear some actually genuinely radical ideas?
Yeah, go on, let's do it.
Always.
Really?
Always.
Okay.
Always.
I'll give you a very simple example of how you could have mass systemic change within the current capitalist system. All right. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. Right now, a tree's only value monetarily is when it's chopped down.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And when it's utilized as a product, be that a pencil, be that a boat. But it is no economic value as a carbon-taking, oxygen-producing, a photosynthesizing tool necessary to regulate climate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So right now, people are talking about things like, you know, there are fucking brands all the time. Like, you sign up, we'll plant a fucking tree. Mm-hmm. We're gonna plant a billion trees.
I like
cool.
this.
But right now,
I know where you're going.
The Amazon rainforest is being
literally on fire. Totally, it's literally on fire.
Yeah.
And Bon Pensero is trying to make people not pay attention to the shit.
100%.
It's literally, while actual Amazon increases in stock value, the fucking Amazon forest is in decline.
So,
the irony of that is when there's no more fucking trees, the cardboard boxes for your Amazon packages they can't be made anymore.
So what are we going to do about it? What are we?
So the thing is, let's just keep iterating this idea. So if you think about an ocean, right now we talk about oceans having huge problems, huge amounts of problems.
I like where this is going.
About carbon. They're actually huge carbon sinks. They're where the majority of the CO2 that's pulled out of the atmosphere is stored. Now, this sort of radical reinterpretation of value is something that would be inherent in dealing with how to redistribute wealth and value, not just monetarily to societies that badly need them. If you don't know about this, in the papers, they talk about the East and the West. There's nothing to do with the East and the West. It's the global North and the global South. And there are basically indebted countries and essentially a group of countries, quite confusing because Australia is part of it, but essentially westernized, very profligate capitalist structures. So the point I'm trying to say is that it's not like these ideas aren't out there, right? But the thing is that the big question is, how do you educate the populace to such an extent that these things start being spoken about in the mainstream? Now, if this was like a couple of years ago, I would have said this is madness. But defund the police was trending on Twitter 3 days ago. And like it or don't like it, it's becoming part of the conversation.
I'm just going to say that I like it.
Yeah.
Good. I very much like it. I don't think anything you're saying is radical alone. I mean, the real radical thing is really going to be, it's the ideological inertia that you are seeing globally. Because what you got to understand is that, like, even just if we just chronicle from the turn of the century up until as recently as 2006, Islamophobia, reality TV, these are phenomena that didn't really exist in our society until the turn of the century. What you noticed was, as George Bush began to assume power in the Republican Party, then News Corp started now having our focus go on to people like your Paris Hiltons and the things that Angelina Jolie did outside of acting. And then we began to have this kind of focus where a new quasi-religion of reality began to exist. And then that began by we took the idea of celebrity and fame being a byproduct of having a talent and having a voice that people identify with. We distilled it from that celebrity. So now you have an entire subgenre of entertainment where, for historically, where you had, you know, you had your Bob Dylans and your Marvin Gaye's, okay, and people that were both, you know, performers as well as activists, or at least provided commentary, is that they have been now been usurped by, you know, a glove people who say nothing and essentially are clothes horses and do serve with corporate interests. Because every time a reality star gets, like, you know, a clothing line or a clothing label, you know, they are utilizing the kind of labor of sweatshops and stuff like that. And we don't think anything about it, because what people see and hear is that, well, if they can make it, look, Charlotte Crosby's got her own clothing line. If she can make it, I can make it. And this is all part, this is just about the revamp of the religion of capitalism.
Well, should we brag them as well a little bit here? Because, I mean, let's be honest. How many well-known comedians, musicians, filmmakers, actors, UK household names literally just posted a black square? That's it. That's all they do.
Loads and loads, and they're pawns in the game, and they're really not looking at the larger picture, I guess. Is, and that's the thing with a lot of people. What you're describing is, you know, I think it may be the only way we can survive as a global society, unless we can create some kind of ecological index where we measure the worth and the efficacy of a country and its government by its ecological practices. We're absolutely fucked. So you notice that countries like Eritrea and Ethiopia are now doing coppicing programs where they are replanting trees, and this is happening all over the continent. If we're not starting to, like I said, have these ideas where we are putting solar panels on municipal buildings, or starting a process of replanting, you know, even, you know, hybrid vehicles for all, like, public transportation as well, you know, even subsidizing companies that are ecologically conscious or do engage in recycling. Like, I even had the idea that, like, how can we can subscribe to Amazon? You can subscribe to Amazon, you can subscribe to Netflix. Why not subscribe to a cosmetic company? And instead of them having to have this output of receptacles all the time for new bits of perfume, you have your receptacle, you have your subscription. You go to, like, a depot, they have a vat of whatever the fuck you want to put on your skin or whatever you want to use, and they give you your, you just grab it. You know, just like in the old, you know, like when you go from water to a well, it's the same thing. It's like, you want more Chanel number 5? Here it is.
It's also really important to understand our very, very recent history. So as early as 2009, David Cameron was on a sled in the Arctic, literally saying we would be the greenest government. Up until 2015, George Osborne had created subsidies so that small British businesses could try to be part of a green revolution. So, for instance, a lot of this is actually small fry stuff, like insulating houses. That's a big one, right?
Without cladding.
Exactly. And, oh, let's not even go there. But the point I'm trying to make is they cut all those subsidies. So we're not actually needing to sort of do something revolutionary in this country. We need to go back to policy platforms that existed pre the Brexit debate. Because the Brexit debate ate everything.
And before that things, as well. Before
there
that.
Are things, I want to say this as well, because a lot of people said to me recently, oh, you hate this country. I love being British. I love part of it. Our intellectual heritage, in terms of, like, what we've got, is an incredible wealth of really forward-thinking people who you know, that's, it's one of the really good things about having a good education system.
And we have an amazing one, yeah.
And these ideas are out there. There has never been a time where academia and reality that politicians enact have been further away, ever.
I mean, I haven't seen it since 1945 or since, like, Pol Pot, where, you know, we've now allowed fake news and alternate facts to be welcomed into our global lexicon without any challenge to it. And now, you know, now when people receive, you know, challenging or adverse views, they can just put it down to fake news. So we kind of have seen it before. But like I said, I believe we are now at the apex of, you know, a post-war capitalist, consumerist-led, you know, prosperity.
End of an era. And definitely
end of an era. It's the end of an era. And people need to accept that. Like you said, people don't like, we're creatures of routine and habit, Howard, but unfortunately human beings are also genetically predisposed to have to adapt if they need to. And austerity, it's not working for no one. And until we all turn around and be like, you stole our fucking money, and want our fucking money back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing is going to change, because everything that you're seeing, everything you are seeing following 2008, because remember, that's when Obama was in power, following 2008 is all this distraction from the fact that they have created this identity politics ideology and stratification of people. So even more progressive groups are all arguing about what separates them rather than unites them. Yeah. And that is this continued division, because they have stolen so much fucking money, and they have sent this part of the West and this free market into free fall since 2008. And now the nerve to report fucking bonuses after we've been bailed out. Now, I studied business at university. Yeah. When you bail out a company and you're investing in it, you either get to asset strip it if it's got fuck all left, or you become a majority or preferred dividend shareholder. I didn't get my bonus check, so why the fuck is RBS getting it?
For real, man.
Until we address that, nothing else matters.
This is so key because, you know, I mean, Adam Curtis talks about this in his films as, you know, a hyper-normal reality that we're living
in. Yes, great film.
The basic way that, you know, you can imagine that is that what people are seeing on the news and then what they actually see with their real eyes are two very different things.
Absolutely.
And that has been sort of extremely depressing about, you know, whether it was care homes, PPE, you know, the whole crisis. And a lot of people are really scared, man. Like a lot of people, I think, don't really have or aren't really. And that's why things like your podcast is great, because you're really trying to give people tools to say when they're having conversations with people, particularly baby boomers, that this isn't really, you know, this can't go on.
I'm going to make a claim, Dane, see if you, Dane's with me on this, listeners, that we're going to forego the format of this show and make this show, this episode of this show, all about this question, and we'll just carry on with this, Dane. You up for that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we haven't gone deep enough. We haven't gone deep enough. We want to go further.
But absolutely, because it's a small question, but this is really the quantum of modern existence, right? Because we have been told that money makes the world go round when actually the natural law dictates that it's a function of gravity and our orbit around the fucking sun. And somewhere along the line, we have forgotten this, because now we are at the height of a technological advance and we still have people alive today saying the earth is flat. So this is where we are, where we're now having to have these existential conversations with each other, where it's like, how is it that you can see space with your phone and people are still saying the earth is flat? Yeah. How is it you've had generations of the descendants who are mixed with the Pict, Celtic and Norman people, essentially our Mongol race, as well as, you know, Saxonic tribes who formed the white people in this country, who at the top of their lungs, when they are asserting their superiority, are like, if you want to live here, you should speak the language.
But that's why they all say all lives matter, Dane. Maybe that's why they say it.
Even that's a very interesting conversation, because
that's probably why they say it, because they're all Celtic, Norwegian, French, German lives that are all part of our lives, which are where our royal family comes from. They all matter.
Yeah, they all matter apart from, but the same people that say that are the same people like, we want our sovereignty back. So you leave your continental European cousins because you don't identify with them either. And then you watch your NHS being privatised. And then, as you said, we look at the state and the level of care that's been received by the same generation. These people always regurgitate as, they fought in a war, so we could. But that same generation are now in these homes receiving no care. And I'm supposed to be still indulging or entertaining this narrative about all lives matter.
Would you mind, rather than getting like us getting stuck in too much to the things that we know are fucked up that we talked about, I'd quite like to get into some fundamental stuff. Like particularly, I want to talk about money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what is money? Right?
Great question.
Essentially, debt. If you have an opportunity, I'd really recommend that you follow an account, have a look at their website. They're called Positive Money. They're a non-for-profit think tank that distributes a lot of information on this subject. But if you also don't know about this, the way that money is created is through the doctrine now of modern money mechanics. And there is an idea of a called fractional reserve banking. And this basically means if I'm the bank, right, and I'm lending to Dane, right? So let's just make this nice, simple metaphor. So how do I get that money in the first place? Well, I take it from a national bank. So the Bank of England is that for us. And that, just so you're clear, listener, is not part of the state of England. It is a private corporate body that controls, that it's part of the Corporation of London, right? That is a private entity that runs a private cabal in the centre of London.
Just like, so you guys can understand, it's like McDonald's has Mook at the beginning, but it's not Scottish.
That's for real, exactly. So this thing, I'm the government at the time, and I say, guys, I need some money. And they say, that's fine. What you do is you issue a bond, and that bond goes over to them for 100 trillion, let's just say. And they then give me 100 trillion in pounds, which I can then put into the money system. Now, that's literally an IOU. That's how simple this is, right? So then I decide to start lending. But the thing is, the modern money mechanics says that I only need to have 20% of what I've loaned out. So when I loan Dane, say, 8/10 of the money that I have, I can then de facto double that. So I've literally, out of thin air, just almost doubled the amount of money I'm able to lend, even though if those people asked to come back and take their money back, I wouldn't have it. That is the way that the banking system operates. And people need to start understanding the fundamental mechanics of the basic units that we, all our lives, go along doing. Because let's face it, no one's counting the pennies anymore.
Exactly. They're not at all.
Barclays mobile app.
Absolutely. Which facilitates fractional reserve banking even more, because now you're just dealing with binary.
We had George Monbiot on the podcast a while back.
George.
Amazing guy. And he talked about, can we end economic growth? Which is quite an interesting statement to people of any background, I think. You can get your head around what George was talking about there. I think the key thing to me when I hear you guys talk about all of these various things is how do we get the person that is still, you know, sucked in by the kind of normality of what we've been brought up on? How do you get them to go, there is something else here?
You can't. And that's the problem. That's the hardest part.
All social change, if you actually look at the history of social change, has always taken place through the actions of small groups of people that create a essentially avalanche of often driven by events that change history. So if you actually look at the amount of people that were busing down in Selma, for instance, it was an extremely
really small. Absolutely.
But the pictures, the images, the idea was so powerful that it changed public opinion. And that is what we're really talking about. And we're talking basically about something called the Overton window, which is the idea that if, for instance, the Overton window is the space that public debate operates within. So, for instance, when Donald Trump's election campaign in 2016, he said Muslim ban, that became normalized and it pulled it to the right. But when people at Black Lives Matter protests start screaming defund the police, that starts pulling it the other way so that people can actually start talking about that in modern parlance. Now, there's two things to address in what Howard was saying. One, obviously you don't try and leave these people behind. I think that's super important to acknowledge. But you also have to accept that we live in a very apathetic, extremely lean-back culture.
Especially here, but that's nurtured. But we have to remember that has been nurtured. This is what I'm saying about the turn of the century, is that you have to look at the phenomenon of, like, you know, our celebration of materialism and consumption in popular culture. Because the turn of the century saw, like, the introduction of, like, Sex in the City and Manono Blahniks. That was introduced with the availability of credit and payday loans.
Yeah.
Because you'll notice that what happened was, is that as Rudolph Giuliani destroyed the mafia, then they gave banks the power to be able to engage in more conspicuous fractional reserve banking, and also give these insane loans and engage in usury that's never been seen before. Because now that you can basically have the equivalent of a Shylock by giving someone a egg credit card or giving them a payday loan with 2,000% interest, that's bigger than even the mafia would charge you for the VIG on the loan.
Did you ever see I did this sketch in The Revolution We Televised where I pretended to be this guy, Naomo, and I went into all the payday lenders and I said, is it more money if it's just cash because it's heavier? And they were like, no, it's...
Yeah.
Well, can I pay you back in weed? And what I was trying to show was that every single one, I said the most fucked up, crazy, ridiculous things. Said I'd been in a mental hospital. Yeah. Said I would use it to pay back a drug dealer. And every single one of them still offered me a loan.
Because I don't care, because you were supposed to be a debt slave. You're not supposed to be repaying a loan. You are a debt slave. If you were, because I mean, I've been having a joke about it, which was met to nonplussed quizzical faces, where I was saying that, like, these people are Shylocks for crackheads, because only a crackhead would be like, oh, so if I trade in a mobile, I get a little bit of money, but then if you lend me £50 now, I got to pay 2,400% interest next year. Well, yeah. I need the crack now. So £50, please. Because, you know, that is the level of despair, economic despair, that we're right at.
bring this back round to something that's super important, which is a lot of your listeners will have heard the term defund the police that's been shouted out again and again. Now, some people want to, just taking back to the abolitionist question, some people want to just get rid of all the police, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of people, if they're white people, are quite confronted by this. I myself have only in the last month learned of the New Cross Massacre, right? Which was something where in the 1980s, a group of young black teenagers were having a party. The police set the place alight. 14 people burnt to death in the flat. And 60,000 black Britons for the first time came in the street and demonstrated. Now, I am a political geek who's made political satire shows, who's worked with investigative journalists, who's worked with Private Eye. I have never, ever heard of this. So don't be confronted by the fact you haven't heard it, but understand that you haven't got any idea.
Well, can I ask as well? Because I'm talking about the story.
Because this is super important.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you've got to ask yourself. So first you've got to take that into consideration. Then you've got to ask yourself, what are the police there for? And ultimately, it's my belief that the police are there to defend capital. They're there to defend money.
Their name is what tells you. Their name are not the good guys. Their name is not the Justice League. Their name are the fucking police. The etymology of the term means policy. That means they're not enforcing what's right. They're not enforcing what's just. They are enforcing policy. And what determines policy is legislation. And what can buy legislation? Lobbyists with money. That is all they protect. So the only reason now, for example, if you're a member of the LGBT community and you come from a certain socioeconomic background, the only reason the police can't fuck you up just for existing now is because there's enough money within that base in order to influence legislation. This is the only difference. The police, and I want to, the New Cross thing is that it's interesting you didn't know about it, because my dad, the first time he bought a car, the reason he could afford that car is because when he was in Brixton, the house party he was in on New Year's Eve was firebombed and he almost lost an eye. And so he got that in compensation, and I wasn't allowed to go to Brixton until I was 18.
You are joking.
I'm absolutely 110%.
So he was actually there?
Not in New Cross. He was in Brixton when they firebombed another house as well. Because this is what, my dad was grew up in Broccoli, and he was a Broccoli boy, which is referred to as a gang. But most of the black gangs that exist in London are because they were combating attacks from NF and other racists. So when we talk about the police, again, going back to that about defunding the police, exactly, what do? Because the police do not preemptively stop crime from taking place. Any victim of domestic abuse can tell you that. They are responsive in terms of how they deal with crime. And really, crime a lot of the time is, we know, is a byproduct of financial iniquity. It's usually the one catalyst that begins people engaging in crime. Now, for me, my biggest, I guess, revelation about understanding how the police works would have been with Stephen Lawrence's murder and the McPherson inquiry, because I live 15 minutes away from there. And so black people in the community started, we were getting alternate anecdotes about stuff like where Dwayne Brooks was being cajoled by the police to paint him as aggressive and then thereby diminished from his testimony. He was falsely implicated in a rape scandal. They accused him of carrying offensive weapons because he used to work and change printers. And now he's working in office and was a Liberal Democrat, I think.
He was a Liberal Democrat candidate.
Candidate because of this kind of injustice. Now, we all know the McPherson Report is probably one of the first times that Britain as a nation became aware of a term like institutional racism. Here's what we don't know. Because remember, like I said, I was 11 and I was 15 minutes away. Name one police officer that got fired.
Yeah, exactly.
Name one.
Not one.
I remember Sir Paul Condon, even when that was happening, was like saying most of the people that perpetrate muggings and robberies are black people. And what you also find is interesting is after the revelations of the McPherson inquiry, rather than the police, like I said, you didn't hear about any arrests. Now, Stephen Lawrence's death is one of the reasons why we had to introduce double jeopardy into law as well, because the four killers, the members of a gang, the Elton Craze, are stabbed to death because they're a gang and they carry knives and everyone knows who they are. Even though we don't talk about knife crime in white communities, the people that stabbed him, now, we know two of those guys went to prison. And incidentally, it's the two of them who were the poorest, who don't have dads, who are members of firms, who could pay off and bribe members of the police, which is exactly what happened. But we never find out what their names are. So instead of that being addressed, and you don't hear about anybody being fired, what you had instead is that the McPherson inquiry and the reintroduction of double jeopardy happened a generation later, where if you were an active police officer at the time covering this up, in 20 years, you'd have probably retired.
Yeah,
you are immune from any kind of prosecution or persecution or scrutiny about
your job. It's worse. A lot of these guys were retiring with basically kind of pensions of like 30 grand, 40 grand. It's like,
but that wasn't enough for them, because what they did after that is they got revenge. And when we get Operation Trident,
Yeah.
So now they've created an entire scheme where they've created this idea that the movement of guns is most prominent within the black community, even though there are no Caribbean or African countries with their own domestic firearms or artillery traits. So they can't be coming from us. However, when you see the troubles in Ulster and you see all these decommissioned paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland, where do their guns go? And guns are banned in the UK because Thomas Hamilton was a convicted paedophile who went to a school in Dunblane and killed all the children. And yet to this day, no one ever racially profiles white men in anoraks and glasses.
I don't know what you're talking about. He was a lone wolf. He was
And then the same thing they said about Anders Breivik. And then he said he had
about the whole this whole defund the police thing, because I think it's super important with it through the podcast to say the pragmatist point of view, the legislative point of view, and the abolitionist point of view. So the thing is that is problematic with defunding the police is what do you replace it with? And there are very real functions, counterterrorism functions, issues of, I mean, you raised the issues of them being reactive. That's absolutely right. But who wouldn't want an officer to be able to go around if a woman was being attacked by their partner? There are very legitimate concerns that people have when they hear these huge crimes. But what also, again, people don't have the knowledge of is the research that's been done into, you know, independent counterterrorism units that can be activated within a kind of a cellular kind of structure of an institution that essentially are, you know, public protectors that would be necessary. No one is talking about getting rid of the police in order to replace it with nothing. And secondly, it's not the case that anyone who's saying defund the police is going, everyone in the police is a racist. You can still work within an institution that has fundamentally conditioned you. I mean, the amount of accounts of black and ethnic officers saying they were called bounties, you know, black on the outside, white on the inside.
I was one of them. Fuck you guys.
There you go. There you go.
No, fuck them. I agree with what you're saying, but to be honest, I think we're at a particular stage. I don't give a fuck about any kind of moderate things from any pragmatist. Fuck you and defund the fucking police and go fuck yourself. You know why? Because I work in comedy. And in comedy, people are happy to satirize the government and they're happy to satirize religious institutions like the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Forgetting that both of these institutions, as I said before in the podcast, we determine our very rudimentary idea of morality from Judeo-Christian fundamentals. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, etc. Right? Now, we take that as a basis for our legislation. Mm-hmm. And that all comes under the term common law, where it's like commonly you shouldn't go around killing people and stealing people. So this becomes the policy. The people enforce that are the police. Therefore, if we are all happy to say these two institutions are corrupt and rotten beyond repair, why the fuck can you not say the same thing about their kids? So if you ask them, for me, if you're still a police apologist, go fuck yourself. You're wrong. They're evil. Fuck them. Because if the church is corrupt and the state's corrupt, then they're fucking corrupt. And they're worse than us. They're worse than us. Now, fuck that. They're worse than us. You know why? Because in comedy, I am told, not there's a problem, but I am told from a moral perspective, if I see somebody being traumatized and discriminated against because of their gender or sexual orientation, just as a civilian, you should speak up. Even of patriarchal power, use that leverage and speak up. Therefore, if you're in a fucking police and you know what that stands for, and you see one instance of someone acting outside the boundaries of law, more before I say a fucking word and I even hit the streets with a placard, you should be turning them in. And if you don't, you're worse than all of us.
That's the whole thing, isn't it?
Fuck you.
This whole thing, sorry, guys, Dane like popped his Xanax halfway through. And then,
no, I didn't. When it comes to the police, fuck them. When it comes to the police, fuck them. Fuck them and fuck you if you believe in the police.
You know what?
If you're the policeman, more than anybody else, you should be the first one of us to talk about crime and corruption within your institution. You should be more disgusted than any of us. That means if you don't, you're the worst.
Here's the biggest problem that we face right now as a society is in the UK, is that I actually agree with the fearsomeness and the venom with which you're talking. And I feel actually, when we talk about the revolution we televised before, the one thing we didn't do enough of was focus on directly on the police. We did a couple of sketches, but more about police bribery than anything else. And the truth is that the staggering statistics about, say, 4% of the UK population being black and 50% of the prison population being black also points to another really important issue, which is that how can 96% of the UK population ignore the subjugation of 4% of the population? And how can, just like Howard's saying before, what is it going to take? What are you going to need to see in order for you to understand that you have to stand up against an institution that just hasn't come for you yet.
See, what I think it could be is the absolute collapse that we're going to see in America in the coming years. And I love America. I studied in America. I've got a lot of friends in America, and obviously their culture massively dictates ours, music, film, everything else. But there is about to be a massive collapse out there in the coming years. And I hope it's not as bad as it could be. I don't think there's any way of stopping it. I don't think Biden or anyone could stop it. But I think what is going to happen out there is going to be so massive. I don't know if you guys have heard about the water shortage crisis in America, which when you say...
Flint, Michigan has been without clean water in a developed nation for like over half a decade.
But, and the idea, Dane, that there are people who run out of money and the water company turns off their water in a pandemic is, I mean, anything we used to aspire to be America. Everyone aspires to be America, right? The place of opportunity. Fuck me. They are done for in the
We're pretty done for here as well, my friend. Exactly. You know, like right now, conservative estimations are that literally by December, we will have lost about 35 to 40% of jobs in the market. And it's extremely sad because, I mean, we're talking about this money thing. I saw something earlier today that came up. This theatre in Southampton, the Nuffield Theatre, it's been open for 40 years, does community outreach with difficult groups. It works with vulnerable children. It works with, it's been a huge community hub, and it's being shut. And what you've seen is there is absolutely no doubt that putting another trillion, even putting 2 trillion, on the current national debt would not be a big deal because we've just bailed out, 80% of the workforce through the PAYE scheme, the self-employment scheme. There are things that are going to go on here. And I think what's going to happen is exactly like Dane said at the beginning, is the way that companies will deal with it is to fully upscale and accelerate their plans for automation within the workplace, which creates less jobs anyway. And then we have fundamental questions to ask ourselves about who are we or what are we?
Exactly.
What is the point of what we're doing on this planet?
Exactly. You know? And capitalism has allowed human beings to ignore the existential question for generation after generation. And now we are arriving at a point whereby your money is not going to bail you out of it. Because once automation exists and you have an artificial intelligence that does not require water, sleep, or any kind of religious allegiance whatsoever, you're done. That's number one. Not only that, the basis for your superiority, biologically, socially, is now being shown is bullshit. So now what's happened now is that you have an entire lot of people based in the West who have enjoyed an emperor's new clothes status, where they have all of the same moral, social, and theological shortcomings as any other nation on the planet, but money has allowed them to appear to be superior. Now that that's running out, and now we can see you're no better than anybody else, which is why we're saying correctly, Jodian was saying, satire has become much more difficult because what are you parodying? Oh, you know what would be crazy? A president that gets pissed on by porn stars. Well, now it fucking happens.
So I know. And there's this crazy story I heard. It's really, really funny. It's about a president who is friends with a child sex trafficking ring who suddenly had photos taken of him in Russian hotels and information like sworn affidavits that, I don't know, some crazy fictitious group, like, I don't know, let's call them Anonymous, started putting out in 2016, seeming to suggest that they may have raped a child. Like, this is how fucking insane.
Sir, my president, if he's going to have sex with a teenager, it'll be his own daughter. You heard him. That's fake news.
For legal reasons, I want to be super clear that what I just said is obviously a joke. I mean, who could possibly... Yeah.
Allegedly is the word that we'd like to make clear.
I certainly didn't name any president. And if you, for some reason, in your own mind, have decided to draw some spurious sort of conclusion that would somehow make defamation of his character like a clear legal case, well, that's on you, Chuck. That's on you.
That's definitely on you, Chuck. Whereas over here, I'd have to worry because that never happens to my prince because he can't sweat.
Well, that's been an unbelievable talk today, isn't it, Dane? We haven't done our normal format of questions because the question we had was worthy of a whole episode.
You introduced my esteemed guest as an anarchist, and therefore we have dispensed with our classical format, but it's been wonderful. You know I love you, baby. It's always good to see you.
Oh,
you know,
I love you too, bro.
You know how we do.
We have to get you back on the show.
Exactly. You know how we do.
You know how we do, baby.
But you know what the thing is? This is what I would say to anyone who's like really confronted by a lot of the things that we've talked about. It's okay.
It's okay.
Scary, man.
It's okay.
They're big things, but also there's amazing resources out there. And if you know, you follow us, you'll see all this stuff that is out there in the ecosystem, which hopefully, you know, we can curate for you. And I am hopeful. Like, I want to say that. Like,
absolutely. That's the best part. It's humanity. That's the best part of this. And for those listening as well, like, we are describing very daunting and what appear to be insurmountable odds. But you have to remember that you, just as a species, have existed before all of these systems. We have endured and we have adapted and we've evolved and we have succeeded all of these systems that we were told there's nothing better than. And this is only the same thing that's happened now, is that this has just worked to a point. We've now reached that apex. And now it's time for us to evolve socially, globally, you know.
I just hope that when we evolve, it's not as difficult as that moment at the end of the Avengers films where Doctor Strange tells Tony Stark there's only one chance, because we will fuck that one chance up. I hope there's a big chance for us to change it.
This is my guy. Like, I love that we've got back to an Avengers metaphor. Like,
I mean, it's the closest one.
I mean,
it's the closest one, man. It's you know, us initially rejoicing in global imperialism and strength, and then seeing a threat that's bigger than all of us. Mm. Yeah. And you know,
Jolien, come back on the show at some point, and we'll do some more.
Do the live show.
Do the live show, please. When we're allowed in public again.
But listen, thanks a lot for having me on, man. It's been a lot of fun.
We'll speak to you again soon.
Pleasure, man. Good to see you, brother. Have a wonderful day.
Yo, you know I love you, D. I'll speak to you soon, man.
Thanks again, bro.
Peace. You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeaste. Our guest was Jolien Rubinstein. You can follow Jolien on Twitter and Instagram at JolienRubs. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Decode. You can follow D on Twitter and Instagram at OfficialDecode. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.